Thank you everyone for being here for the GiveWell research event tonight. This is a really awesome turnout and awesome crowd, and it's really nice to see some old faces that I've been talking to for a while at these research events, as well as some new faces. So welcome everyone. I'm Catherine Hollander, a research analyst focused on outreach at GiveWell. So just quickly for the agenda this evening, I'm going to speak about the latest research that GiveWell has been working on in 2018, and then leave plenty of time for questions during this session, and then we'll break. There's still some pizza left, so hopefully folks will help themselves to more pizza, and mingling and hanging out and speaking to me and the other GiveWell staff that are here is strongly encouraged. We want to meet everyone and chat with you if you have questions and get to know why you're here and how you found us. And I'll introduce the other GiveWell staff at the end. We're all excited to meet you. And that's sort of the format for the night. We have this space till 9 o'clock. This part of the talk will go for about an hour, and we'll chat and hang out after that. As a reminder, for those of you that have been here before and for those of you that are new, we generally record GiveWell research events to share on our website with folks who couldn't be here today. So I'm recording currently. If you ask a question during the Q&A period that you would prefer not be included in the recording or transcript that we produce, please just email info, I-N-F-O, at givewell.org in the next 2 days, and we'll remove it before we publish it. But we like to be able to share for folks who are not based in the New York or San Francisco area what we talk about at these events. I'll also repeat your questions for the sake of the recording. So I'm going to start just with a very brief overview of what GiveWell is and what we do. I know some of you are familiar. Others of you I heard are here for the first time. So just to make sure everyone has kind of the basic overview of what GiveWell is working on. If you have any questions just about sort of the basics of how GiveWell operates, I'm very happy to chat afterward, or feel free to ask in the Q&A. All questions are welcomed. And then, I'm hopeful that will set some of the context for the research that we're working on this year. So I will then talk about some of the sort of major research questions that we have in our mind related to the current group of top charities that we recommend that we're focused on answering this year, some of the work that we're doing to identify new top charities, and also some of the work that we're doing to incubate and develop potential future top charities. So just starting quickly with the kind of overview of what GiveWell is, our focus is on finding charities that have the highest impact per dollar and recommending them to anyone who wants to use our research. So the product that we produce is a short list of top recommended charities that's on our website and available to everyone. These top charities work in the poorest parts of the world. They work in global health and development, and the types of programs that they work on are things like treating intestinal parasites, distributing insecticide-treated nets to prevent malaria, and distributing direct cash transfers. We currently have 9 charities on our list. These charities are selected based on questions that we try to answer to understand sort of who to recommend and how to rank them. And there are 3 basic criteria that we're looking at when we're thinking about which charities we might recommend. The first is, what's the evidence of the charity's effectiveness? And we actually start that research at the program level. So a program is anything, is the thing that the charity is doing, but independent of what the charity itself is. So just to make it less abstract, a program is distributing insecticide-treated nets. The charity that GiveWell recommends that does that is the Against Malaria Foundation. So we first look at the evidence for the program, whether something like distributing insecticide-treated nets is effective. The second thing that we look at is how well it works. So we're interested in, how effectively the charity is able to deliver that intervention, how strong their ability is to demonstrate that they have reached the people that they're intending to reach, and what we know about those outcomes. So that's our first criteria. The second that we look at is the cost effectiveness. So as I mentioned, we're focused on trying to find charities that have a very high impact per dollar. And so we are extremely interested in what are some of the cheapest ways that we can find to help people. And so we spend a lot of time looking for the programs that we believe can do the most good per dollar donated. So cost effectiveness is a really important criteria of ours for all the charities on our list. The final criteria that we look for is how much additional funding a charity needs and whether they can effectively put additional dollars to use, since the product that we're producing is a list of top charities that people will donate to and direct dollars to. We want to make sure that every additional dollar can go a long way. And so, you know, as I mentioned, we use this criteria to identify our list of top charities. The nine charities on our list currently work on a variety of programs, and we're interested in recommending additional charities. We find additional charities that, you know, work on other programs that meet our criteria. And in 2017, we estimate that we directed around $117 million to the top charities that we recommend. So that is something we're very excited about, and, you know, thanks in part to many people in this room. We really appreciate that, and, you know, are hoping to continue to move a lot of money to the great groups that we recommend. And so I mentioned that the first thing I wanted to focus on is to talk about the sort of biggest research questions on our mind in 2018, the things that might change our opinion the most about the current group of top charities that are on our list. And so there are sort of three major questions that we're looking at right now. You know, the first thing that we're looking at is research that's been done on the impacts of cash transfers. So cash transfers are the intervention that is implemented by one of our top charities called GiveDirectly. They've been on our list for a long time, and what they do is that they deliver cash directly to some of the poorest people in Kenya, Uganda, and Rwanda. And this year, some new research came out on the impacts of cash transfers that had sort of two major suggestions. And before I get into those, I just want to kind of start with our bottom line, which is that, you know, we are planning to look closely at this new research, and that we, you know, expect that our views could change a lot as a result of it, but our best guess is that we will continue to recommend GiveDirectly once we're done with this review of this new evidence. So the research that came out basically had, you know, two kind of, it suggested that cash transfers might be less effective than we previously believed in two different ways. The first is that cash transfers might have negative effects on the people who do not receive them, or spillover effects. We currently assume that cash transfers do not have major negative or positive spillover effects. So if your neighbor gets a cash transfer, we don't assume that you're much better off, and we don't assume that you're much worse off. This study that came out this year, and if you follow development econ blogs, you've probably heard about it, caused a bit of a dialogue to happen there. It was a three-year follow-up study of a GiveDirectly program that distributed cash transfers of about $300 to about half of the people who live in a given village. And this study suggested that the people who did not receive the transfers were worse off. And so, you know, for GiveWell, as a recommender of cash transfers, we are definitely very interested in this question. You know, if it turns out that cash transfers have these negative spillovers, you know, that might really influence our bottom line. But there are a few reasons that we think that this particular study isn't directly applicable to the work that GiveDirectly is doing today, and are planning to wait for the results of another major study that's being done on a version of GiveDirectly's program that is much more similar to what they're doing now. And we expect results from that study to come out in the next few months. So the version of GiveDirectly's program that they're currently implementing in Kenya and Uganda is to give $1,000 transfers to all members of a village. So I mentioned that in the study that came out this spring, they're dividing the village and only giving transfers to about half of eligible recipients within the village. GiveDirectly is now operating in a model where they are making transfers that are both larger, about $1,000, and to the whole village. So negative spillovers may still occur. Our best guess is that if they do, it would be between villages rather than within villages in the current model. But we're waiting on this major study that I mentioned is coming out. We expect, I think, midline results from the study in the next few months to sort of do our really big deep dive into what we believe about the impacts of spillovers. But this is something that we're watching quite closely and that we plan to do a deep dive on before the end of the year. And the second, I mentioned there were two questions that got raised about cash transfers due to new research this year. The second question was on the duration of benefits. So Right now, we think that people benefit from receiving cash transfers in two different ways. The first way is that you benefit from being able to buy things right away. So things like food, you know, immediate consumption benefits. And the second way is that you are able to invest some of your transfer and have benefits that might accrue to you, you know, 1 to 20 years in the future. And the new research that came out this year suggested that the medium-term benefits might not be as significant as GiveWell assumes in our current model. We have not done a deep dive on this yet either, as we're planning to revisit it as part of our big look at cash transfers once we have the new results of the midline study that I mentioned that's coming out, looking at the program that GiveDirectly is implementing today. But we think that this is a really important question. With the duration of benefits and how long we expect benefits to last, we think that the sort of floor for how low our cost effectiveness could fall is about 1.5 to 2 times. And the reason for that is because we currently assume that about 60% of transfers are just consumed right away. So even if you completely remove the 40% benefit that it happens over the medium term, we still end up feeling pretty positive about the benefits of cash transfers. But certainly this is something that could make GiveDirectly look a bit worse. And so we're planning to follow this pretty closely this year. And so right now we're at the sort of medium term update on this, but we don't have kind of our big conclusions and are planning to publish that by the end of the year. And so the major bottom line is that this might change our view significantly. We could imagine that will happen in a positive way. There is an argument to be made that there might be positive spillovers from cash transfers, or a negative way, and we're not yet sure. But our current best guess is that we will continue to recommend GiveDirectly. So that's the first kind of major research question on our mind, which is on cash transfers. The second is related to insecticide resistance. So I mentioned earlier that we have a top charity called the Against Malaria Foundation that distributes insecticide-treated nets to prevent malaria. And these nets work in two ways. The first is that they provide a physical barrier, so they block mosquitoes from biting you. And the second is that they kill the mosquitoes because they are treated with insecticide. And we are concerned about a potential increase in insecticide resistance. Our impression is that it's increasing across sub-Saharan Africa. And we've done several reviews over the years of studies that have been done to try to better understand, you know, how potentially significant this problem could be. However, what we found in those reviews is that there aren't any high-quality studies that estimate the impact of insecticide resistance on insecticide-treated nets' effectiveness in the field. And so we don't currently have a lot of information about the scope of this problem. Because the Against Malaria Foundation is one of our top charities, we think that this is a really important question for us to be asking. And so this year, something that's new is that a new type of net is being tested. It's a new type of insecticide-treated net called a PDO net. And so the way that this works is, and I'm not a biologist, so please forgive the very simple explanation, but the way that I understand it is that PBO is a synergist that works by blocking the enzymes in the mosquito that sequester the insecticide and prevent it from having the toxic effects on the mosquito. So these nets, we've seen some initial evidence that looks promising on the fact that these nets might work well. There's been one randomized controlled trial, which is a particular type of study that GiveWell uses a lot to look at the impacts of the health interventions that we recommend, where basically you divide a group of people in half, randomly assign half to get the treatment, which in this case would be a PBO net, and half to the control, which would be people receiving the standard insecticide-treated net, and then look at the differences between those two groups. And so this initial evidence that we've seen, we think looks positive, and we also think of this as being pretty interesting as a potential proxy for the current level of insecticide resistance, since we can compare how effective these new nets are with the PBO to the old insecticide-treated nets. And we actually, it's not considered ethical to randomize people to have untreated nets, and so we don't have that information about how current insecticide-treated nets compare to untreated nets or PBO nets to untreated nets. So that's why we think this is a sort of interesting proxy for that. And so, our current kind of next steps is we're waiting for another randomized controlled trial of PBO nets in Uganda to be completed. The Against Malaria Foundation is distributing those nets. That's the top charity that we have that I mentioned. And we're planning to then revisit our estimate of the relative effectiveness of PBO nets to standard nets and to incorporate that into our understanding of the efficacy of nets, and also to incorporate into our cost-effectiveness model the areas in which the Against Malaria Foundation is distributing these nets as opposed to the old nets, since we expect that there would be differences both in the cost of the nets as well as the impact of the nets. And so that would factor into kind of our bottom line that I mentioned that we produce, which is a look at how expensive it is to produce a particular good outcome, in this case, averting deaths from malaria. The third question that I wanted to talk about is one that we think is really challenging, which is that donors, anyone who's giving to charity, and anyone who, like GiveWell, is in a position of making recommendations or suggestions for where someone might give to charity, has to make a challenging moral judgment call between different positive outcomes to try to come to some sort of bottom line to say that you should donate here to have the most impact. And concretely, what I mean is that, you know, we currently look at charities that work on a very wide range of interventions. This is from, you know, the Against Malaria Foundation, where we think that the benefit is averting deaths from malaria, to cash transfers, where we think the benefit is being, you know, having the ability to buy more things, to groups, you know, that work on, you know, deworming, which we think increases incomes later in life. So that there's a very broad range of outcomes that we're looking at. And when we're trying to come to a bottom line and say, here's where we think your dollar can do the most good, can go the furthest, we have to make a trade-off between those outcomes to say, how valuable do we think it is to increase someone's income relative to something like improving their health? And so, you know, it's really important for us to get good inputs here on how to make this decision, since it's driving, you know, funding decisions and recommendations that we're making. And so, you know, right now what we found is that the information that exists that we can use to inform this decision is quite poor. There's not a lot of information out there about how, you know, people in the parts of the world where GiveWell's top charities operate would make these same trade-offs. And so the current way that we approach this question is sort of the best that we can. We have staff members input their individual inputs into the model that we use to look at the cost effectiveness of different interventions. And those inputs are shaped by things like global health research, philosophical worldviews, thought experiments, and research. And so, you know, each member of GiveWell's research team might trade those values off differently based on these factors or other factors that they consider important. But we think that this is suboptimal, since it does not include information on the preferences of people who receive the benefits of our top charities. And so we first looked to see whether there was research that was done on this, and found that there wasn't, that there is some research that exists on how people in rich countries make these trade-offs, but very limited information on how people in the poorest parts of the world would. And so, you know, in the medium term, our plan is to go out and gather this information ourselves. And so we're working with this group called ID Insight, which is a group that we've worked with for a few years through our incubation grants program, which I'll talk about in a minute. And they're sort of a unique group that's focused on providing decision-relevant information to policymakers and implementers. And so we're working with ID Insight to go out and survey beneficiaries of our top charities to see how they would make these trade-offs between income and between health. And so they've done this year a pilot, which we have some initial results from, that they conducted in Kenya earlier this year. I think it was in February, where, you know, basically what we learned from this pilot is that it's very challenging to ask these questions. It's very hard to design a survey to give you information that is, you know, easy to understand and interpret. And so, like, for example, one of the questions that this research focused on was this question I've been talking about, the value of averting deaths versus increasing income and consumption. And it was very unclear what to make of the results, because ID Insight used a few different framings to ask this question to try to understand, you know, whether people might answer the question differently if it's phrased differently and framed differently. and they got very different answers from those different framings. So it's hard to know what we should make of what we got back from that survey. And so we're considering now, with this information, having done the pilot, funding another pilot that would use different approaches and framings so that we can see whether, you know, we might be able to learn more from that that would affect how we think about these trade-offs in our model. And we're also interested in seeing whether a different population, maybe in a second pilot, would give different results. So, you know, the first pilot was done in a part of Kenya. Maybe people in a different region would have different answers. It was also primarily, the first pilot was primarily speaking with women because they were the easiest to survey. And so we might also wonder whether men would give different answers. And so we're currently in the process of thinking through how we might design a second pilot to help us get better information to inform this really important piece of our cost-effectiveness model, where we think we just currently don't have very good information and are doing the best we can with what we have, but are excited that we might be able to fund and generate more information to inform this really important output. The final thing that I wanted to mention about our current group of top charities that I just think is really important to kind of keep in mind as sort of a big picture check-in on sort of where we are in the world and how things are going, which is that one of the projects we did this year was a review project to look at the overall size of the total global need for insecticide-treated nets, and also another anti-malaria intervention called seasonal malaria chemo prevention, which is another program that GiveWell recommends, where you're giving preventive anti-malarial drugs to young children during the time of year when they would be most likely to catch malaria. And so we are very interested in funding these two interventions since we think they're both very effective ways to prevent malaria. And so we wanted to get a better sense of what the total funding needs are in each of these spaces to get, you know, see kind of how much additional funding might be necessary to fill the global gap in these areas. And what we found was for nets, we used information from the RBM Partnership to End Malaria, which was formerly called Rollback Malaria. And for the seasonal malaria chemo prevention data, we looked at information from Malaria Consortium, which is our top charity that we recommend that works on this program, and wanted to find out what they believe the funding gaps are in these spaces from 2018 to 2020. And our conclusion based on their research is that there's a gap of about $640 million to deliver nets to all the people who need them. So $640 million, which is significantly more than what we moved to our top charities last year. It's a very large gap. The largest gap there was in Nigeria. That's about half of the gap, so like $330 million roughly of need that we see in Nigeria. And for seasonal malaria chemo prevention, the anti-malarial drug program, the gap was $165 million. So again, this is a lot more than the total amount of money that we directed via GiveWell. And I think just speaks to kind of where we are currently. You know, we hope that we can direct more funding to these opportunities and that there still is quite a large need for, you know, what we believe to be some of the most evidence-backed and cost-effective ways of helping people. And, you know, we do think that there are reasons that the gaps might shrink relative to this initial estimate that we have. You know, one was that the estimated gap for 2017 was relatively small. The RBM partnership believes this was due to large contributions from a funder that won't repeat this year, that's no longer available, but that could be one reason that the gaps could be smaller than we think. Another is that Nigeria is working to get funding from development banks, which could reduce their need, and as I mentioned, you know, they're a significant portion of the need, both for nets and also for seasonal malaria chemo prevention. And then the final reason, you know, the gaps could be a different size than we initially estimate is countries' own ability to reallocate funding between their different programs. So that's kind of the usual GiveWell caveat that this is the best guess that we have and the best conclusion that we have currently. And then here are the reasons why it might be different from that. But we still think the kind of, you know, big picture bottom line is that there is a significant need here. And so, you know, as donors, we think it's really important to have the kind of total picture in mind that there still is a long way to go. So that's the kind of broad update on our current group of top charities. I might pause here and take a few questions on this before I move on to the work that we're doing to identify new potential top charities. If you have questions on the new top charities, we'll take those after, but let's take a quick pause here and talk about the current top charities. Yeah.
Do you have any Yeah, just as I understand it, the concern about the insecticide resistance is that insecticide resistance could make the bed nets less effective. Is there a risk in the other direction that you would be increasing insecticide resistance by spreading these nets?
Yeah, so the question is our concern with insecticide resistance that insecticide resistance makes the nets less effective? And are we also concerned that we could be increasing insecticide resistance by using the new nets? So the answer to both of those is yes. We think that the concern with insecticide resistance is that the nets that are treated with a particular type of insecticide will be less effective. And so the idea is that there are different types of insecticides. So mosquitoes would become resistant to one type of insecticide, but not necessarily a second type of insecticide. Although it's always, the resistance could develop in both directions, or, once we shift to using a different type of net, then you become concerned that, resistance could grow to the new type of net. So you're always kind of trying to outrun the mosquito's development of insecticide resistance. And yes, anytime that you use insecticide, you are, increasing the risk that mosquitoes will evolve to be resistant to it. But I think that because you can introduce new types of insecticide that mosquitoes aren't yet evolved to, we see that there are significant benefits to doing that over something like an untreated net or, sticking. As I mentioned, we have the one study that's been under the new nets that shows that they're more effective than the current group. And so that's what we want to see and to implement. And so, we think that that's sort of the best path. But certainly, PVO resistance could occur down the line as well, and we need to think about that too. Yeah, so who is ID Insight and who works there? So ID Insight is a very large international NGO. They have an office in San Francisco, which is where GiveWell is based, but they also have a number of country offices. I'm not positive they have a country office in Kenya, but they employ a number of field researchers who are the ones that go out in the field to conduct survey work. And so we see them as really unique in the sort of global health and development space, because a lot of the research that GiveWell relies on in making our recommendations comes from groups that are very aligned with us that specifically focus on global health and development, and also academia. And we think that academics aren't necessarily always incentivized to provide the information that's sort of most decision relevant for GiveWell, either because it's not kind of aligned with their career incentives. We're very interested in things like, very targeted research on specific areas that our charities might actively consider working in. And so, we found is like academia doesn't always have the kind of most decision relevant information that we need. And ID Insight is unique because they focus explicitly on providing this type of targeted information where we can come to them with a question as sort of a meta research evaluator, and then they can go out on the ground and help us answer the question. So GiveWell doesn't do kind of on the ground research ourselves, but ID Insight is coming in as a very aligned group that we're working with to help fill those gaps in our knowledge and working with us on that.
I'm trying to estimate the value of a life or a healthy year. Have you guys tried looking at how much of the current giving that GiveWell has done has gone towards medical spending or preventative medical spending, and trying to extrapolate from that? And or has anybody ever looked at something similar to the developed world where you see jobs where people take, riskier or less risky forms of mining or farming, even if it's not in Uganda, maybe similar incomes in India or something?
Yes, the question is sort of how have we looked at the information that GiveDirect currently collects on whether people are spending money on, health-related items, and also have we looked at things like revealed preferences surveys in other parts of the world that look at whether people are more willing to take a particular type of job at a particular pay with a higher risk of death, which is one way that that I understand that in richer countries, this question of how people trade off income and health is often done, which is just looking at how much more do you need to pay someone to work in a job with a higher risk of death. We're not sure how applicable the research that's been done on that is to the context in which our charities work, which is the very poorest parts of the world. But we did look at that type of research when we were thinking about what information is already out there. So we have seen it. But we are interested in sort of the more context-specific information to where our charities work, since we could imagine that people might make these trade-offs differently in the poorest parts of the world relative to the rich countries in which this is done. or the research is often done. And then on the first part of your question, what have we looked at the sort of breakdown of spending of GiveDirectly recipients? The answer is yes. And in our GiveDirectly review, you can see the research that we have on what people tend to spend their transfers on. But when we at GiveWell are modeling the benefits of receiving cash transfers, we're focused on the increase in consumption as the sort of primary outcome of interest. So we're not modeling health benefits via the potential to spend on health goods kind of explicitly in our model of GiveDirectly, but we, you know, have seen the information that's available there, and that might factor into individual staff members thinking about how they would trade those two off.
So Bill Gates is like trying to eliminate malaria entirely, whether that's through eliminating mosquitoes or something else. Like, does GiveWell have a perspective on whether malaria will be eliminated? Does it factor into your evaluation of things like the medicines that malaria
Yes, the question is, Bill Gates is spending a lot of money on malaria. Does GiveWell have a perspective on whether malaria is likely to be eliminated? I think GiveWell hopes that malaria is eliminated, but we don't currently factor that into how we think about the benefits of providing someone a net today. I think as an organization, we have a very strong focus on what can achieve the most good donating today. And right now, malaria does kill a significant number of people every year and does have these very large funding needs. And so we think it's really important to help people today where we know that there is this evidence-backed intervention. And that if, you know, 10 years from now, we can't recommend the Against Malaria Foundation because malaria has been eradicated, we consider that to be a very successful outcome. We would be very happy about that. We are glad to take things off of our list if the need no longer exists.
But for the medicines, that seems like a different problem than the nets. Because like, I'm with you on the nets, but if somebody's like resistant for 20 years, you think like the future time horizon does play into that, into the value of.
And for the medicines, are you thinking of something like, is the preventive anti-malarial drug?
Yes.
So I think those drugs are administered very regularly. I think the goal is once a year, maybe twice a year. And it's the kind of thing where you have to have it like re-upped regularly. So it's not a vaccine that lasts for 20 years. This is like a very near-term intervention that prevents people from getting malaria today. Sort of in a similar way to, we think that insecticide-treated nets last for about 2 years before they degrade to the point where they are no longer as useful at preventing malaria. So nets get holes in them, that type of thing, that makes them less effective over time. And so we think that these are sort of short-term preventative measures, and that anti-malarial drugs would fall into that camp. So it's not sort of a long-lasting vaccine, but rather a, you know, shorter-term intervention. Yeah. And I think just looking at the time, I'm going to talk a bit about our top potential top charities. We can definitely come back to questions on our current top charities post that, but just to make sure that you get the full download, we'll talk about our potential top charities now, and so come back to these questions in a little bit. So, you know, as I mentioned, those are all of our big research questions, or some of our big research questions related to the 9 groups that we currently recommend. We have this basically 2 parts to our research process. The first part is scanning the world of potential interventions. So I explained earlier, an intervention is a term that we use. We use it fairly interchangeably with the term program, which just means the sort of abstracted thing that you can do to help someone. So distributing insecticide-treated nets, giving vaccines, distributing cash transfers, treating intestinal parasites. That's separate from what the charity does. Separate from a particular charity. And so the second part of our research process is looking at the particular charities that are implementing those programs. So step 1, looking at all the potential programs that we could potentially recommend. And then step 2, looking at the charities that implement those programs. And the reason that step 1 is looking at all of the interventions at the intervention level is because we found that the differences in the evidence of effectiveness and cost effectiveness, so 2 out of those 3 criteria that I mentioned at the beginning of the talk, those differences are primarily driven by which program a charity is implementing. So it's a much bigger difference in a charity that is implementing the program of insecticide-treated nets and a charity that is implementing a program of providing surgeries in the United States. the differences in the programs will drive a lot of the differences in the cost effectiveness between those two groups. So that's why we think it's sort of the logical first step to start at the intervention level. So we focus on, you know, our first part of our research on which interventions have the best evidence and are the most cost effective. And so at GiveWell, what this means, you know, in our office is that we have a huge spreadsheet of, I don't know what the total number of rows in the spreadsheet are right now. Some of our research analysts here might be able to help, but something like 100 plus different potential interventions that we might look into that we are prioritizing to try to think about how much time we should spend researching them, how promising they are, whether we should ultimately elevate them to the level of what we call a priority program, which is the point at which we say, you know, we've looked at the evidence for this intervention. We think it is strong enough that we're excited to kind of start the next phase of our research, which is finding a charity that's implementing that program. And the way that we add things to our dashboard is sort of a combination of, you know, reviewing new academic literature that's coming out. We follow the journals quite closely, like the Lancet and New England Journal of Medicine, to see whether there are programs that are, you know, popping up there through new studies that we should have on our radar. And we also have conversations with charity representatives and academics that we think, you know, are helpful to us in terms of keeping an eye on what new research is coming out and what we might want to investigate further. And so one intervention, just as an example, that's recently come out of this process is screening and treating pregnant women for syphilis infection. Your current best estimate of the scope of this problem is that there are about 1.4 million pregnant women that have syphilis. And the complications from not treating that are stillbirth, neonatal death, and potentially long-term complications for the child. There is a very simple point of care, meaning it can be administered right where the patient is, intervention, which is diagnosing whether a woman has syphilis and treating it with a simple dose of penicillin. So there's a cheap, simple way to address this problem that we think seems like it's potentially, you know, something we want to look into. And our best understanding is that this intervention, syphilis screening and treating, is currently neglected within the global health and development community. It's a fairly small problem in the scheme of things. We think there's probably about $10 million worth of funding need to treat this group of women, which might explain why we think that it's fairly neglected, meaning that it's not receiving other funding, why we think that GiveWell might want to recommend it so that we could direct dollars to it. We spoke with the person at the World Health Organization who's in charge of this program, and they told us that they spend less than half of their time per year working on this, and other funders that we've talked to don't seem to be very focused on this program. So we think that this might be the type of thing that has the combination of, you know, there's strong evidence that the screening and treating program works, that it might be potentially competitively cost-effective with the current top charities that we recommend, and that it might be neglected. In other words, that there might be room to fund this program. So because of that, we are planning to continue to research this program that's kind of come through our prioritization dashboard. And, you know, one thing about this program that we think might also make it a fit for GiveWell is that we don't think that it is likely to appeal to mass market donors. And it doesn't seem like any of the existing entities that we might expect to take action on this are likely to take action. So we think there really might be a gap here that we can fill. The problem that we have found with this is that if we decide to fund it, we're not sure who to direct funding to. So I mentioned the two steps of our research process, intervention prioritization, and then looking for charities that implement them. We have found through GiveWell's history that sometimes we run into a sort of roadblock where we've identified a program that we're interested in, but not a charity that we can direct funding to that's implementing the program. And so this kind of, you know, this problem is not, you know, unique to syphilis, but it is something that we're interested in addressing. And so the way in which we're planning to address this and have started work on addressing this is through our incubation grants program, which I briefly mentioned earlier, is the way in which that we've been working with that group ID Insight that we were talking about earlier. And so we're interested in whether we, as GiveWell, can direct funding to things that would enable the creation and scale up of a charity that others could eventually support in the form of a GiveWell top charity. So can we fund organizations at an earlier stage that we would recommend them as top charities to donors? I mentioned we have, you know, pretty strong criteria for what we look for in our top charities. We really want charities to be very evidence-backed and have a very good track record. But through this program, can we support things at this early stage to scale them up to the point where we might recommend them as top charities? And so, you know, one of the grants that we're currently thinking about in this category related to the above syphilis treatment is a grant to a group called Evidence Action, which you might be familiar with if you have followed GiveWell for a while. They're the parent organization of two of GiveWell's current top charities, the Deworm the World Initiative and a group called No Lean Season, which we added to our top charities list last year and is a seasonal migration program in Bangladesh that was actually an incubation grant recipient itself back in 2014 that kind of came through this newer program that I mentioned where we're trying to grow potential top charities. And so we're considering giving Evidence Action a grant for a part of their work called Evidence Action Beta. And the idea here is to go from Evidence Action's current model of picking programs that seem promising and sort of slowly scaling them up to working with them as sort of an incubator that has a broad portfolio where we can look at with them at a lot of ideas kind of at the beginning and hopefully lead to more top charities over the long run. And so syphilis screening and treating is a potential program that could be part of an Evidence Action Beta grant. And you know, overall with Evidence Action, like they are a group that we have worked with for a long time and feel very closely aligned with. And so we're excited about the possibility of making a grant like this to help us really you know, not only support things via recommending them to donors that we think are great, but to, you know, enable the development of things that we think could be really exciting for donors in the future once there's more evidence there. And so, you know, that's kind of the overall goal of the incubation grant program, having more top charities and better understanding the current group of top charities that we recommend. And you know, I think this type of grant is really illustrative of the work that we're doing there. So I'm going to pause here for more questions on this or the earlier part of the talk on top charities or any other things that are on your mind. We have about 10 more minutes, so we'd love to answer any more questions.
When you were talking about GiveDirectly, you said there are some negative spillover effects. Can you talk about some of the outcomes? If you're familiar with like what you mean by that, so your neighbor, non-recipients of direct dollars, how on what outcomes are they faring poorly? Is it negative attitudes or lower wealth or health issues? And are there any theories as to why that's happening?
Yes, the question is basically more information on the potential negative spillovers for GiveDirectly. So I know GiveDirectly has done some research themselves on the sort of emotional spillovers. I'm not sure that that is the correct term, but thinking about like, are there jealousy impacts? Are there impacts on those feelings? We talk about those in our GiveDirectly review. So there's more information there that I can share with you. And then on the recent study, I think that's looking primarily at economic outcomes and economic spillovers. Although I'd have to double check that. So I'm happy to get back to you on like what concretely they looked at. And then you know, for us, since the consumption, you know, impact is really important, we would be really interested to know if there are major economic benefits or, you know, negative impacts on neighbors, but also if we learned that there were significant psychological, you know, well-being impacts, we would be curious to incorporate those as well. And so we're waiting to do our really deep dive on this until that larger study comes out, since we think it'll be more telling for what we should do as it more closely resembles the current GiveDirectly program. So yeah, I don't have a lot more information off the top of my head on the sort of shorter term results that we looked at, but I'm happy to follow up with you on the what we're looking at there. Yeah. Yeah.
I'm wondering about just like the whole framing
Yes, the question, or the, you know, concern is basically, can you do something that is evidence-based and feel like you really are confident in the answers that you get, knowing how many challenges there are in framing these questions, or how people might respond really differently to frames, and how well do people understand the trade-offs that they're being asked to make, and really, you know, this whole project seems really challenging. How do we get anything useful out of it? So I mentioned, you know, they used two different framings in the initial pilot that they did that gave these very different answers. And maybe just to kind of give a more concrete sense of what they are, the framings were called the taking framing and the giving framing. And the taking framing was asking, how much money would you pay to basically avert the death of, they asked about a number of people, but like your spouse, a child of a particular age, yourself. And the giving framing is a donor is interested in funding, you know, cash transfers or something that will save the life of, you know, a spouse, yourself, children of different ages of yours. And looking at the different answers that you get to those two framings, a concern with the taking framing is that people might be, they might feel limited by what they believe that they can borrow in current markets for what they would answer for that amount of money. And the giving framing gave a really different answer, where there was basically no amount of money, I think is what they concluded, that would be traded off against averting a death as the median answer. And I think it was about $1,000 in the taking framing. So just getting really different answers makes this really complicated to interpret. And so I think we're aware of the challenges in doing this, and I think trying to approach this and thinking about what information could we get from this that we would believe could be a meaningful input in our cost effectiveness analysis, and you know, how much skepticism should we approach the answers with. So you know, I think we're very aware that this is a really challenging question to answer, and are planning to treat the responses that we get as sort of carefully and thoughtfully as we can, knowing that these are the challenges of getting good information in a survey like this, where there is so much potential to have confusion or complications in answering.
Are there any overlap populations where there will be a single person and who could potentially benefit from either program? You can ask them up, straight up, which
would you rather have? Yeah, are there any individuals who would, say, potentially receive a cash transfer and also an insecticide-treated net? I don't know off the top of my head. I would guess the answer is yes, but I'm not sure even, I'm not, like, quite sure how you would frame that question the way we're, it's all very...
You know, based on the amount of in terms of per unit of giving...
You're not going to give somebody $1,000 worth of nets.
Yeah.
Well, you have to divide it by the appropriate number.
To what extent is BedNet sort of funded by charities such as the Vegan Solidarity Foundation versus spent by, I guess, like governments in Africa to provide these solutions? So you mentioned that sort of funding gap. I guess, like, would it be effective, I guess, to sort of letting governments to sort of, like, money,
Yeah. What's the so the question, I'm just repeating these for the sake of the recording. So the question is how much of current net spending is done by governments versus groups like the Against Malaria Foundation? And also have we thought about encouraging governments to spend more on nets? Right. So I'm not sure off the top of my head what the breakdown of government versus AMF funding is. I'm happy to follow up with that I don't know it off the top of my head. In terms of whether we might try to encourage governments to do more with net spending, we, you know, see the Against Malaria Foundation does work with some governments. You know, they have to get, you know, government agreements to work in different countries. But in terms of sort of political advocacy, I think we are interested in whether that type of work is the type of thing that we can assess going forward. But I think in this particular space, I'm not aware of groups that we would assess to do that type of advocacy. I think malaria is a pretty well known issue, and I think, you know, country governments do fund it to some degree. So I'm not quite sure like what the advocacy space would look like within this area. But we do know that we can give money to the Against Malaria Foundation and believe that they'll scale up net use. So I think for now we do think that is a really good option for us to provide funding towards.
wanted to ask about the motivation behind doing the IDN site work. Mm-hmm. So is the assumption that people who are the targets of the intervention, who be benefited by the interventions, have better information about how their lives would be improved by the interventions versus money, like, you know, their lives continuing being, you know, lengthened or, you know, getting more money? Is that the assumption they have better information, or is the assumption that even if they had no better information, we should defer to their preferences over our own preferences?
So the question is whether, basically, like, how we would think about the responses we would get back from a beneficiary preferences survey if we would assume that beneficiaries have maybe equivalent information that GiveWell has about the impacts of the different interventions, or whether we would assume, or we would just wait, we would weight their preferences, you know, sort of above GiveWell staff members.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah, I think, you know, that the sort of weight to which individual staff members might put on beneficiary preferences versus, you know, other considerations that they might have will, my guess would be, will vary in the future. And I think that some factors that could drive that would be sort of your personal views on things like paternalism, like how comfortable you are saying, you know, I know I have really good information and that I, you know, am positioned to help someone make a decision, or whether you say, I don't think I should have any role in deciding what someone else should receive and that that is fully, you know, up to them. And we see this, you know, with GiveWell staff and also with GiveWell's group of donors who use our research. I know that a lot of the donors that I've spoken with that give to GiveDirectly, of our list of 9 top charities, choose to do so because of paternalism and concerns about paternalism feeling particularly strong for them, and that that could be a reason why a GiveWell staff member or a GiveWell supporter today decides that they would value cash over something else. You could imagine taking beneficiary preference responses and sort of applying a similar logic to how you incorporate those and how you make those same trade-offs.
Yeah, so kind of back to one of the other points about deciding between the nets and, you know, money, let's say. Do you guys have a consistent unit of good, or also what, like, how do you decide that this particular value is good, right? Because in different parts of the world, to different people, different things are considered good, right? So is there a consistent unit of good? Is it like good points, like,
yeah,
effective things, like?
Yeah, so do we use a sort of standardized unit of good that we look at when we're kind of coming out with a bottom line, and how do we think about the fact that what we think might be a unit of good would be different than,
yeah,
what someone else would consider? And so in terms of the specific GiveWell approach, we use arbitrary values to make those trade-offs. So if you actually go into the cost-effectiveness model and look at the tab where individual staff members make these trade-offs, and it's public on our website, so anyone who's felt inspired by this conversation to go in and see how we do it, or to put in your own values, that is on our website. So the way that we do it currently is that we're just comparing them relative to one another, so we're not saying we have a sort of bottom line unit of good that we're translating all of our top charity outcomes into, but we're saying I value income twice as much as health. And that gets plugged into all the other assumptions that go into our cost effectiveness model, such as, you know, how effective you think bed nets are, how much insecticide resistance is a factor, what, you know, you think the duration of benefits of cash transfers are. Like, there are many different factors sort of beyond these moral trade-offs in our model. Those all come together into a bottom line outcome where we can pair their cost effectiveness relative to one another, and we make those comparisons via each individual outcome of a top charity that we recommend. So that is a very abstract sentence. And so what that means is if you go into our cost effectiveness model, it will say this charity costs X dollars as much, or sorry, the relative benefit of this charity is X times as much as cash transfers or X times as much as malaria nets. You can say the Against Malaria Foundation is 6 times as cost effective as GiveDirectly, and that the cost per outcome is equivalent to, and then you can choose any of the outcomes on our list and say, like,
it's really relative per dose.
Yes.
So it's like you get this amount of good points per dollar for this dose.
It's per outcome. So you can say that, like, this outcome, if this top charity were implementing a program with a different outcome. Here's the cost of that outcome. So then you can look at it along all of those lines. And it might be easier to look at it because I think I'm not explaining it in the most clear way out loud. But in our cost-effectiveness model, you can see that this is the cost per outcome as good as averting the death of a child under five. Cost per outcome as good as giving someone $1,000. And then you see those values for each of our top charities, and you can select the different outcomes that you're making those comparisons of. But we're not sort of explicitly publishing, like, this is how many units of good you accomplish. Like, we're putting it either into relative terms, comparing our different top charities, or we're putting it into the unit of a particular outcome that is translated via the cost-effectiveness model. Come see me after, I'll pull it up, because I think I'm not explaining it as clearly as I could out loud, but we can look at it on the sheet. And I think we'll do one more question, because we're almost at an hour, but then we'll have lots of time to keep talking after that. So, yeah.
To also piggyback off that question, I know in a lot of development studies, I always hear quality-adjusted life year as kind of a metric used to compare different interventions across different, whether it's health or there's cash transfer or whatever. Is there a reason why GiveWell wants to kind of look at an alternative to that, and also to what extent is it playing your current research?
Yeah, so the question is that quality-adjusted life years and disability-adjusted life years would be another kind of common metric that's used in global health, and why doesn't GiveWell use those? We actually used to use disability-adjusted life years, or DALYs, in our cost-effectiveness model, but what we found is that GiveWell staff were ultimately using them in an unconventional way, where we were weighting sort of the deaths at different ages differently to what the sort of standard global health approach was for using DALYs. So it was no longer useful to us in sort of making the trade-offs that we were making in the way that GiveWell staff were making them to use that metric, that common metric. And so I think it was just in 2017 that we switched away from doing that into the more the sort of arbitrary, you could put in whatever baseline number you want and compare it according to your own values to get your sort of own bottom line outcome, and why we switched away from DALYs. So the kind of short answer is just that we were no longer using them in a conventional way, so that it wasn't helpful to us to use them, since it would be more confusing than illuminating to look at them if you were familiar with DALYs. So I'm going to pause here, since it's been an hour, and say, how much I appreciate all the questions and everyone here and your interest in and support of GiveWell. It's really, I love coming here and seeing everyone and talking to you all, and I'm planning to be here for quite a bit longer, so would love to continue the conversation one-on-one, and then I'm also going to ask Tracy to stand up, and Dan and Caitlin. Tracy, Dan, and Caitlin all work at GiveWell. They can all talk a lot about the research that we're doing and the projects that they're working on, and we'd really love to meet you, so strongly encourage you to chat with them as well. They can talk about any of these questions that I was just talking about, and also many things that I don't know about, so you should definitely talk about that as well. We have the space until I think about 9:30, so hang out, please. There's more pizza, and I hope that we can all meet and get to know each other. So thank you again for coming. Really, really appreciate it.